former Vico CEO Bill Allen takes the stand in the Ted Stevens trial, describing gifts he passed along to the senator. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 30th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, longliners in Southeast struggle to keep sperm whales from stealing their catch.
I mean, is this not a natural behavior of these whales? It's a learned behavior, and it is definitely, in my mind, escalating fairly rapidly at this point.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The voter registration deadline for the November 4th general election is approaching. Voters have until Sunday, October 5th, to register or update their existing voter registration. Forms are available at any Division of Elections office, municipal clerk's office, and at tribal offices. Forms are also available at elections.alaska.gov or by calling 1-866-952-8683. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
The government's star witness took the stand today in the trial of Senator Ted Stevens. Bill Allen was once a respected businessman in Alaska and ran Vico, one of the state's largest private companies. But he pleaded guilty last year to bribing state lawmakers, and prosecutors say he gave Ted Stevens gifts worth more than $250,000. Stevens is accused of lying about the gifts on his Senate financial disclosure forms. As APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington, today's testimony scratched the surface of what Allen has to offer.
Bill Allen doesn't look all that different now than he does in a portrait taken back when he was Vico's CEO. It's the same white hair, the same portly figure, but the 71-year-old has lost his smile and now seems tired and drained. It's been a major fall from grace for Allen, who took the stand Tuesday to testify in the trial of a man who used to be a close friend. Allen started by explaining why his speech is sometimes faltering and why he has to search for certain words. A 2001 motorcycle accident damaged the part of his brain that controls word recall, but Allen said it did not affect his memory. The prosecutor then walked Allen through his biography. He grew up poor in the lower 48 and went from being a welder's assistant to starting his own company. At its height, Vico had thousands of employees and took in $800 million to $1 billion in revenue. Allen said he and Stevens were part of a circle of friends who took fishing trips together. The senator didn't react when Allen talked about his admiration for Stevens' work ethic and love of Alaska. Then prosecutors got to the reason they called Allen to the stand, gifts he allegedly gave Stevens. Allen said he and the senator traded vehicles in 1999. Allen swapped his Land Rover for Stevens' 1964 Mustang and $5,000. Allen said the trade probably wasn't even because the Mustang wasn't in the mint condition the two claimed at the time, but he said he did it simply because, quote, "I like Ted." Allen talked of supplying a generator for the Stevens Girdwood home because Stevens said he needed one to prepare for Y2K, the year 2000 bug. Vico employees installed the $5,000 to $6,000 unit on the clock. Allen said Stevens never paid him back, and when asked if he paid Vico, Allen said, quote, "I don't know. I don't think so." The prosecutor asked Allen if he knew of Stevens' house in Girdwood. He replied that, in fact, he, quote, "helped him build a house there." More details about what exactly Allen and Vico did at the Stevens home will have to wait until Wednesday when court resumes. Stevens' lawyers claim the senator knew nothing of his old friend's activities, and they'll have a chance to cross-examine Allen soon. But some things are off the table. Defense lawyers aren't allowed to tell the jury Allen is being investigated in Alaska on two counts of having sex with teenage girls. They can only say Allen is facing an investigation and ask if that's influencing his testimony in this trial. The defense attorneys are happy, however, with the decision the judge made Tuesday that Allen can only tell the jurors he pleaded guilty last year to bribing state lawmakers. He can't say who, because Allen claims he bribed Stevens' son, Ben Stevens. Ben Stevens has not been charged with a crime. The judge said mentioning his name would prejudice the jury. The start of Allen's testimony came in the final hour of court Tuesday. The rest of the day was spent on other witnesses, including two VECO employees who talked about doing odd jobs at the Stevens Girdwood home. One hired specialists to help with repair work and said he thought Stevens or Stevens' son Ben said they would pay the contractors, although paying VECO was never discussed. Senator Stevens' former press secretary, Courtney Boone, testified about fielding a call in 2004 from a reporter asking if the senator had not paid for work done on his house. The reporter credited an unnamed source with the information. Boone said her reaction was likely, quote, "Are you kidding?" But she asked Stevens, who said his wife Catherine handled the work on the house. Prosecutors entered into evidence an email Boone wrote to the Stevens couple, saying she found out that the house deck was built by a contractor who used some old pipe from VECO. The email also said they'd figured out the reporter's inside source, a fired VECO employee described as a disgruntled foreman. Boone said Catherine Stevens showed her receipts and canceled checks from the renovation project, and that as a press secretary, she tried to get the story to go away and didn't bother to mention VECO's involvement in the renovation. Stevens did pay Christensen Builders $160,000 for work done on the house, but prosecutors say the project actually cost more than double that price and that VECO gave Stevens numerous freebies. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
2007 was a very good year for Alaska businesses, so much so that for the first time ever, the Alaska Business Monthly's annual 49er Awards showed two state-based businesses crossing the $1 billion mark in gross revenues. KSKA's Len Anderson attended Monday's ceremony.
For two dozen years, Alaska Business Monthly's October issue has honored the state's top grossing businesses. To qualify, a business has to be over 51% Alaska-owned and headquartered in the state. Dave Stroh, co-host for the ceremony held at the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce's Monday luncheon, pointed out the companies also had to meet an ever-rising revenue challenge.
Last year, the entry level was $35.5 million. But this year's number 49, Ken Brady Construction Company, needed to post $43 million.
The two top positions for the first time were both held by a pair of Alaska companies that had risen above the $1 billion mark. Number two was the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, which experienced an over 30% revenue increase in 2007. Arctic Slope Regional Corporation continued its 18-year first-place run, with the last 5 years at over $1 billion. But as Alaska Business Monthly's Vice President Jim Martin noted, ASRC was now pushing closer to a new historic revenue level.
This year, with nearly an 8% increase in gross revenues, ASRC has advanced to $1,834 million. And President and CEO Roberta Quintavelle can see the ever-increasing possibilities of the next higher billion-dollar watermark.
Nana Development Corporation was the third-place 49er with 2007 revenues of $975 million. This year's top five were all Alaska Native corporations, as were eight of the first 10. The exceptions to the Alaska Native dominance were Linden Incorporated, which was sixth, and 10th place Chugach Electric Association. Altogether, the 49er companies have some 23,000 Alaskans on their collective payrolls, plus thousands of other employees outside the state and country. Their 49 combined gross revenues totaled just under $11.8 billion. According to Martin, not everyone posted a better year in 2007 than in 2006.
Of the 49 companies, 39 reported an increase in gross revenues last year, and only 10 experienced a slight decline. 10 49ers tallied a better than 50% growth last year.
EAC Corporation's gross revenues showed a 140% increase. Tetitlik Corporation was over 75%, with Ken Brady Construction and Frontier Alaska both above 70%. Editor Debbie Cutler has worked on the last 11 Alaska Business Monthly 49er lists. Cutler is not certain what the turbulent economic situation of 2008 will produce.
I can't predict what next year will bring, the stock market, the financial bailout. I mean, I don't know how it's going to impact Alaska, though I think eventually it'll catch up to Alaska, and eventually we will have to tighten our belts, and we will have to just be a little more cautious so our economy stays as strong and stable as it is.
Those negative impacts may already be showing. Peninsula Airways, Pen Air, ranked 35th on this latest 49er list. Late last week, Pen Air announced it had laid off 15 pilots and parked three of its turboprop planes as the company tries to reduce the impact of high fuel costs. A spokesman says the airline is some $6 million over budget. According to its 49er description, last year Pen Air listed gross revenues of just over $70 million. Again, the top 49er list is published in the October issue of Alaska Business Monthly. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a potential downside to the PFD.
It could possibly be depressing wages in Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. You can prevent costly damage to the environment with an inspection of heating equipment and fuel oil tanks. Spills can contaminate drinking water and stormwater drains, which can cause health problems for people and animals. Technical assistance is available online at dec.state.ak.us. Click on the Spill Prevention and Response link for assistance to the Home Heating Oil webpage. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
Longliners on the inside waters of southeast Alaska encountered some unusual and unwelcome fishing partners this summer. A couple of sperm whales followed at least two different boats in Chatham Strait, pulling black cod off their gear. Their appearance adds more urgency to the concerns that increased interactions could be bad for both the whales and the industry. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Tori O'Connell was fishing black cod in Chatham Strait in August when her longline vessel was joined by a couple of sperm whales.
You could hear them communicating very well by standing out in the bait shed, and the intensities of their clicks would increase rapidly, as I think that they must have been zeroing in on prey.
Sperm whales eat squid as well as groundfish like black cod, and they're known to go after longlines filled with the fish as the gear's hauled up from the depths of 1,000 feet or more. When O'Connell pulled in her gear, it was clear that these whales were going after some of her catch.
We had quite a few straightened hooks on the skates that seemed to be depredated. You know, for instance, you'd get 50 fish on a skate, and then all of a sudden you'd get seven, and there would be a lot of straightened hooks. And then the other sign of depredation would be getting heads back that were cleanly bitten off.
As a retired fish and game groundfish biologist, O'Connell is well familiar with the fact that sperm whales go after black cod on long lines, but these giant, toothy, square-headed marine mammals are not typically seen on the inside waters. They live and feed in the much deeper outside waters off the continental shelf. In her 25 years of working for the Department of Fish and Game, O'Connell had never heard of sperm whales moving to inside waters like Chatham Strait until now. And O'Connell was not the only longliner who encountered the animals in Chatham this summer. Earlier, a pair of sperm whales, maybe the same ones, followed around a fish and game research vessel that was doing a longline survey of the black cod fishery. Biologist Mike Vaughn was on board.
You know, like I said, we weren't quite convinced that they were feeding that first day, but we finished our three sets for the day and went into port. And when we came out in the morning, they found us and were pretty much with us for the remainder of the survey.
Fishermen have raised concerns about sperm whales going after their catches on the outside waters for years, according to O'Connell, but she thinks the appearance of these whales on the inside waters adds more urgency to the problem.
The fleet was concerned about this way back in 1982, not only because it economically is costing them money, especially in this day and age when the quotas are low and fuel prices are high, but also sperm whales are listed as an endangered species, and the fleet does not want to be, you know, entangling whales and having whale mortalities. And they have been working really hard to try and come up with deterrent methods to keep the whales off the gear. I mean, it is not a natural behavior of these whales. It's a learned behavior, it is definitely, in my mind, escalating fairly rapidly at this point.
In the U.S., sperm whales have long been protected under the Federal Endangered Species Act of 1973, though they were once widely hunted by commercial whalers. O'Connell hopes to avoid future problems for the whales and the longliners. She's part of a team of scientists and fishermen who've been working on deterrence techniques. The project's called SeaSwap, the Southeast Alaska Sperm Whale Avoidance Project. Sitka's Jan Straley, a prominent marine mammal biologist, is also part of the SeaSwap team.
We've been studying it for a number of years, and it just is a slow process. We've found out that the cues the whales are using is the engine cycling, when the engine is taken in and out of gear when the line is being hauled back or recovered after being set and soaked.
So far, Straley says the effort has produced some ideas for passive deterrence. That includes running into shallower water after setting gear to try and lose the whales before coming back and hauling. Straley acknowledges such methods may not be cost-effective or practical for everyone.
Fishermen have to weigh, well, is it worth just having some fish taken off my line or actually making an effort not to have the whales near me.
Straley says the team's hoping to test some acoustic deterrence in the future. There's no reliable population estimate for sperm whales in the North Pacific, according to the National Marine Fisheries Service. In its 2008 stock assessment, NIMS does not document any cases of the animals being killed due to longline gear. It does, however, say that between 2002 and 2006, observers in the Gulf of Alaska observed three animals they said were seriously injured, which means they were entangled gear but released alive with some gear still attached. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
A research scientist from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reports that the surface layer of the world's oceans have acidified by 30% in the last 60 years due to increased atmospheric carbon dioxide levels. And he says continued unconstrained CO2 emissions may triple ocean acidity by 2100. KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports.
NOAA research scientist Jeff Short says deep sea water corals were just recognized as being extensive in Alaska waters in the last 15 years. Enormous gardens of these corals have been discovered not only in the Aleutian Islands, but in the Gulf of Alaska, as well as in Southeast Alaska. He says almost half of the corals lie in water depths of 200 meters or shallower, which is directly vulnerable to acidification from surface mixing. And he says we are in danger of jeopardizing the integrity of these coral communities before we even know what is really there. Without a doubt, Short says, CO2 emissions from fossil fuels are responsible.
Unlike with climate change, there are very few alternatives, really none, apart from controlling emissions to avoid this outcome.
Short says as CO2 concentration in the atmosphere goes up, it drives more CO2 into the seawater through simple equilibrium partitioning.
This is the same process that occurs when people who make carbonated beverages increase the concentration of CO2 in contact with just regular old water, and it makes fizzy water. Same physics involved.
But when the CO2 increases in the seawater and combines with the water molecule, it produces carbonic acid, and that undergoes a reaction which produces a bicarbonate ion and a proton, which increases the acidity of the ocean. Short went into a fairly lengthy description of how the chemical equilibrium works. He says the net effect of increasing CO2 in the atmosphere causes it to interact with H2O and also with a carbonate ion to produce two ions of bicarbonate.
Now, the reason this is so critical is because you hear this term, ocean acidification, and you think acid, but most of the biological effects, at least the ones that we know about, are not really associated with the acid per se. They're associated with the depletion of the carbonate ion. And that's because that carbonate ion is what an awful lot of creatures in the ocean use to make shells.
That makes basically any organism that grows a shell particularly at risk. The poster child for oceanic acidification is a fairly obscure snail called a pteropod. Some of the first work on acidification focused on these snails. And Short says, until recently, except for a handful of people, the scientific community hadn't realized the seriousness of this issue. But he says this research exposed the pteropod to conditions that are going to be present in the North Pacific habitat in the next 40 to 50 years, which opened the eyes of scientists.
and it shows the shell disintegrating within 48 hours of exposure to those conditions. So this suggests that these animals will have a very difficult time surviving if acidification progresses along the business-as-usual emissions path for CO2.
The pteropod may seem insignificant, but besides providing baseline data for ocean conditions, it's also a very important part of the Gulf of Alaska food web.
Pink salmon, in particular, accumulate up to 45% of their body mass from preying on these snails. So their loss in the Gulf of Alaska could have direct impacts on fishery productivity for at least pink and probably chum salmon as well.
Short says we have very little time to control this downward slide. He says following the same emission patterns that we are, coral reefs worldwide will be depleted in about 50 years. He says the big things that need to be done are to put a moratorium on new coal-fired power plants worldwide and to figure out a way to capture carbon from existing power plants. And one caller from Harvard suggested scientists should also educate our political leaders on these issues.
You have either you or any of your colleagues briefed your governor on this important topic?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Seems like that'd be an important thing to do.
Short says a crash program involving conservation and developing alternative energy sources is also needed because, he says, fossil fuel combustion is definitely the culprit. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
The Division of Elections reminds voters that Tuesday, November 4th, is Election Day. Polling places will be open from 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. To find your polling place, call 1-888-383-8683. If you need language or other assistance while voting, you may ask the election board or bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Division of Elections.
While many Alaskans received their PFD by way of direct deposit earlier this month, many have had to wait longer. But the remaining PFD checks go out in the mail today, and residents should see them arrive in the next couple of weeks. However, some scholars say there's a downside to the PFD. KBBI's Emily Schwing has more.
Everyone loves to get a PFD in Alaska, and Homer area residents are no different. And with the addition of this year's energy rebate, many shoppers are buying the same thing, heating fuel.
Buy some more heating fuel.
Is that all you're going to use it for?
Gas money. Get back and forth to work.
I put it in the bank, and I'm using it for fuel.
Just for fuel, that's it?
Well, for fuel and basically to buy other things such as a new vehicle.
I bought an elliptical trainer and a tank full of propane.
Outside Homer's drug and hardware store, Kim Alexander tells me she thinks Alaskans deserve a PFD.
We work hard. We really do. And it's a tourist town. And, you know, we barely survive through the winter because there's not that much work going on. So I really think, you know, people do deserve a PFD.
But University of Alaska Anchorage professor of economics Gunnar Knapp says that might be the wrong attitude to have.
Nobody enjoys paying taxes. But if you do pay taxes, you have a little bit of a sense of, well, I'm contributing my share. I bought this school. I bought this road. You know, you drive along and see those signs, your taxes at work. You sort of feel an involvement and a stake in things. But if everybody's just sort of getting money, then it's more like a sort of trust fund.
Knapp says the PFD could be hurting Alaskans just as much as it's helping them.
There's a whole potential effect of the permanent fund dividend that has not been talked about much, but some economists, including myself, think it could possibly be depressing wages in Alaska, and in effect, the state government may be subsidizing employers' wage payments.
Knapp explains that the PFD could reduce the incentive for employers to increase wages.
And so, so long as employers in Alaska can point to the dividend program and say, you know, if you live here, the state's going to give you money, then they don't have to pay people as much to live here.
And Knapp says Alaskans shouldn't get too comfortable when it comes to including the dividend in their annual budget.
There's no way that it can help us to our sort of political issue of how do we convince Congress that it should be sending money to Alaska to help with whatever.
But Homer resident Melissa Carlin says she won't be too concerned if the money should run out.
I think it's a bonus. I don't rely on it, but we're grateful for it every year.
Reporting in Homer, I'm Emily Schwing.
A Yukon Kuskokwim Delta elder and lifelong educator passed away last weekend. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
Well-known elder Gladys Jung passed away this weekend in Bethel at age 91. Jung is perhaps best known as being the first woman teacher from the region. She was born Gladys Hall in 1917 in the village of St. Michael. While she was still young, her family moved to the Kuskokwim to the village of Akiak. They took a boat up the Yukon River and then portaged over to the Kuskokwim by foot. Gladys went to the territorial school in Bethel and graduated from high school there. She went on to graduate from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in the year 1938. She married Henry Jung from Sleipmute, and together they taught in many villages on the Kuskokwim River, including Napuskiak, Napakiak, Kipnuk, Kalskag, Tuluksak, and Sleipmute. But she told KYUK in a recent interview that her first teaching job was in a village that no longer exists.
In a small village back here on the tundra, that's called Nunatchok. It's no longer in existence. But that was the only school that they had on the tundra villages. That was the only school they had at the time.
Jung's memory remained sharp. She remembered how life in the region was back in the 1930s and 40s. She says the villages she would teach in would sometimes pack up and leave for a month at a time.
They'd go out springtime camping, fall time camping. They never stayed in the village. That's why they, they never got their schools started and so on, because the people were not in the village. They had to keep going because they had to make a living. Nomadic life, that's what they had.
Even though Gladys Jung never taught school in Bethel, the new elementary school that's being constructed here is named after her. When she found out about the dedication this May, she told KYUK in a different interview that she was shocked.
Well, when I first heard that, I was just speechless. And then I was weepy.
Her lifelong dedication to education will live on at the Gladys Jung Elementary School, and so will Jung's humble nature.
I feel like I'm glad that they wanted to have me there, but at the same time I think, why me? So I'm very proud and humbled to think that I would have a school named for me here. In Bethel, I never, ever dreamed of such a thing.
Gladys Jung had 11 children, 17 grandchildren, and 21 great-grandchildren. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka, Emily Schwing in Homer, and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and October, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. Lack of maintenance is the primary reason heating oil tanks contaminate drinking water, sewers, and stormwater drains. Homeowners are liable under state law for the cleanup of spills from home heating oil tanks on their property. So prevent spills by arranging an inspection of tanks and heating equipment before and during the heating season. Information online at dec.state.ak.us. Click on the Spill Prevention and Response link. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at aprn.org.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.